Chapter 69. Lord Ashley, of the Cabal, was now Lord Shaftesbury, and was strong against the succession of the Duke of York. The House of Commons, aggravated to the utmost extent, as we may well suppose, by suspicions of the King's conspiracy with the King of France, made a desperate point of the exclusion, still, and were bitter against the Catholics generally. So unjustly bitter were they, I grieve to say, that they impeached the venerable Lord Stafford, a Catholic nobleman 70 years old, of a design to kill the king. The witnesses were that atrocious Oates, and two other birds of the same feather. He was found guilty, on evidence quite as foolish as it was false, and was beheaded on Tower Hill. The people were opposed to him when he first appeared upon the scaffold. But, when he had addressed them, and shown them how innocent he was, and how wickedly he was sent there, their better nature was aroused, and they said, "We believe you, my lord. God bless you, my lord." Apostrophe, the House of Commons refused to let the king have any money until he should consent to the exclusion bill. But, as he could get it, and did get it from his master the King of France, he could afford to hold them very cheap. He called a parliament at Oxford, to which he went down with a great show of being armed and protected, as if he were in danger of his life, and to which the opposition members also went armed and protected, alleging that they were in fear of the Papists, who were numerous among the king's guards. However, they went on with the exclusion bill, and were so earnest upon it, that they would have carried it again, if the king had not popped his crown, and state robes into a sedan chair, bundled himself into it along with them, hurried down to the chamber, where the House of Lords met, and dissolved the parliament. After which he scampered home, and the members of parliament scampered home too, as fast as their legs could carry them. The Duke of York, then residing in Scotland, had, under the law which excluded Catholics from public trust, no right whatever to public employment. Nevertheless, he was openly employed as the king's representative in Scotland, and there gratified his sullen and cruel nature to his heart's content, by directing the dreadful cruelties against the Covenanters. There were two ministers named Cargill and Cameron who had escaped from the Battle of Bothwell Bridge, and who returned to Scotland, and raised the miserable, but still brave and unsubdued Covenanters afresh, under the name of Cameronians. As Cameron publicly posted a declaration, that the king was a forsworn tyrant, no mercy was shown to his unhappy followers, after he was slain in battle. The Duke of York, who was particularly fond of the boot, and derived great pleasure from having it applied, offered their lives to some of these people, if they would cry on the scaffold, "God save the king!" Apostrophe, apostrophe, but their relations, friends, and countrymen, had been so barbarously tortured and murdered in this merry reign, that they preferred to die, and did die. The Duke then obtained his merry brother's permission, to hold a parliament in Scotland, which first, with most shameless deceit, confirmed the laws for securing the Protestant religion against popery, and then declared that nothing must or should prevent the succession of the Popish Duke. After this double-faced beginning, it established an oath which no human being could understand, but which everybody was to take as a proof that his religion was the lawful religion. The Earl of Argyll, taking it with the explanation that he did not consider it to prevent him from favoring any alteration either in the church or state which was not inconsistent with the Protestant religion, or with his loyalty, was tried for high treason before a Scottish jury, of which the Marquis of Montrose was foreman, and was found guilty. He escaped the scaffold, for that time, by getting away, in the disguise of a page, in the train of his daughter, Lady Sophia Lindsay. It was absolutely proposed, by certain members of the Scottish Council, that this lady should be whipped through the streets of Edinburgh. But this was too much even for the Duke, who had the manliness then, he had very little at most times, to remark that Englishmen were not accustomed to treat ladies in that manner. In those merry times nothing could equal the brutal servility of the Scottish farmers, but the conduct of similar degraded beings in England. After the settlement of these little affairs, the Duke returned to England, and soon resumed his place at the council, and his office of High Admiral, all this by his brother's favor, and in open defiance of the law. It would have been no loss to the country, if he had been drowned when his ship, in going to Scotland to fetch his family, struck on a sandbank, and was lost with 200 souls on board. But he escaped in a boat with some friends, and the sailors were so brave and unselfish, that, when they saw him rowing away, they gave 3 cheers, while they themselves were going down forever. The merry monarch, having got rid of his parliament, went to work to make himself despotic, with all speed. Having had the villainy to order the execution of Oliver Plunkett, Bishop of Armagh, falsely accused of a plot to establish popery in that country by means of a French army, the very thing this royal traitor was himself trying to do at home, and having tried to ruin Lord Shaftesbury, and failed, he turned his hand to controlling the corporations all over the country, because, if he could only do that, he could get what juries he chose, to bring in perjured verdicts, and could get what members he chose returned to Parliament. These merry times produced, and made Chief Justice of the Court of King's Bench, a drunken ruffian of the name of Jeffreys, a red-faced, swollen, bloated, horrible creature, with a bullying, roaring voice, and a more savage nature perhaps, than was ever lodged in any human breast. This monster was the merry monarch's especial favorite, and he testified his admiration of him, by giving him a ring from his own finger, which the people used to call Judge Jeffreys' bloodstone. Him the king employed to go about and bully the corporations, beginning with London, or, as Jeffreys himself elegantly called it, to give them a lick with the rough side of his tongue. Apostrophe, and he did it so thoroughly, that they soon became the basest and most sycophantic bodies in the kingdom except the University of Oxford, which, in that respect, was quite preeminent and unapproachable. Lord Shaftesbury, who died soon after the king's failure against him, Lord William Russell, the Duke of Monmouth, Lord Howard, Lord Jersey, Algernon Sidney, John Hampden, grandson of the great Hampden, and some others, used to hold a council together after the dissolution of the Parliament, arranging what it might be necessary to do, if the king carried his popish plot to the utmost height. Lord Shaftesbury, having been much the most violent of this party, brought 2 violent men into their secrets, Rumsey, who had been a soldier in the Republican army, and West, a lawyer. These 2 knew an old officer of Cromwell's, called Rumbold, who had married a maltster's widow, and so had come into possession of a solitary dwelling, called the Rye House, near Hedesden, in Hertfordshire. Rumbold said to them, what a capital place this house of his would be from which to shoot at the king, who often passed there going to and fro from Newmarket. They liked the idea, and entertained it. But, one of their body gave information, and they, together with Shepherd, a wine merchant, Lord Russell, Algernon Sidney, Lord Essex, Lord Howard, and Hampden, were all arrested. Lord Russell might have easily escaped, but scorned to do so, being innocent of any wrong. Lord Essex might have easily escaped, but scorned to do so, lest his flight should prejudice Lord Russell. But it weighed upon his mind, that he had brought into their council Lord Howard, who now turned a miserable traitor against a great dislike Lord Russell had always had of him. He could not bear the reflection, and destroyed himself before Lord Russell was brought to trial at the Old Bailey. He knew very well that he had nothing to hope, having always been manful in the Protestant cause against the 2 false brothers, the one on the throne, and the other standing next to it. He had a wife, one of the noblest and best of women, who acted as his secretary on his trial, who comforted him in his prison, who supped with him on the night before he died, and whose love and virtue and devotion have made her name imperishable. Of course, he was found guilty, and was sentenced to be beheaded in Lincoln's Inn Fields, not many yards from his own house. When he had parted from his children on the evening before his death, his wife still stayed with him until 10 o'clock at night, and when their final separation in this world was over, and he had kissed her many times, he still sat for a long while in his prison, talking of her goodness. Hearing the rain fall fast at that time, he calmly said, "Such a rain tomorrow will spoil a great show, which is a dull thing on a rainy day." Apostrophe at midnight he went to bed, and slept till 4. Even when his servant called him, he fell asleep again, while his clothes were being made ready. He rode to the scaffold in his own carriage, attended by two famous clergymen, Tillotson and Burnett, and sang a psalm to himself very softly, as he went along. He was as quiet, and as steady as if he had been going out for an ordinary ride. After saying that he was surprised to see so great a crowd, he laid down his head upon the block, as if upon the pillow of his bed, and had it struck off at the second blow. His noble wife was busy for him even then, for that true-hearted lady printed, and widely circulated his last words, of which he had given her a copy. They made the blood of all the honest men in England boil. The University of Oxford distinguished itself on the very same day by pretending to believe that the accusation against Lord Russell was true, and by calling the king, in a written paper, the breath of their nostrils and the anointed of the Lord. This paper the Parliament afterwards caused to be burned by the common hangman, which I am sorry for, as I wish it had been framed, and glazed and hung up in some public place, as a monument of baseness for the scorn of mankind. Next, came the trial of Algernon Sidney, at which Jeffreys presided, like a great crimson toad, sweltering and swelling with rage. "I pray God, Mr. Sidney," apostrophe said this Chief Justice of a merry reign, after passing sentence, "to work in you a temper fit to go to the other world, for I see you are not fit for this." "Apostrophe, my lord, apostrophe," said the prisoner, composedly holding out his arm, "feel my pulse, and see if I be disordered. I thank heaven I never was in better temper than I am now." Apostrophe Algernon Sidney was executed on Tower Hill, on the 7th of December, 1683. He died a hero, and died, in his own words, for that good old cause in which he had been engaged from his youth, and for which God had so often and so wonderfully declared himself. Apostrophe, the Duke of Monmouth had been making his uncle, the Duke of York, very jealous, by going about the country in a royal sort of way, playing at the people's games, becoming godfather to their children, and even touching for the king's evil, or stroking the faces of the sick to cure them though, for the matter of that, I should say he did them about as much good as any crowned king could have done. His father had got him to write a letter, confessing his having had a part in the conspiracy, for which Lord Russell had been beheaded. But he was ever a weak man, and as soon as he had written it, he was ashamed of it, and got it back again. For this, he was banished to the Netherlands. But he soon returned, and had an interview with his father, unknown to his uncle. It would seem that he was coming into the merry monarch's favor again, and that the Duke of York was sliding out of it, when death appeared to the merry galleries at Whitehall, and astonished the debauched lords and gentlemen, and the shameless ladies, very considerably. On Monday, the 2nd of February, 1685, the merry pensioner and servant of the King of France fell down in a fit of apoplexy. By the Wednesday his case was hopeless, and on the Thursday he was told so. As he made a difficulty about taking the sacrament from the Protestant Bishop of Bath, the Duke of York got all who were present away from the bed, and asked his brother, in a whisper, if he should send for a Catholic priest. The king replied, "For God's sake, brother, do." Apostrophe the Duke smuggled in, up the back stairs, disguised in a wig and gown, a priest named Huddleston, who had saved the king's life after the Battle of Worcester, telling him that this worthy man in the wig had once saved his body, and was now come to save his soul. The merry monarch lived through that night, and died before noon on the next day, which was Friday, the 6th. Two of the last things he said were of a human sort, and your remembrance will give him the full benefit of them. When the queen sent to say she was too unwell to attend him, and to ask his pardon, he said, "Alas! Poor woman, she beg my pardon. I beg hers with all my heart. Take back that answer to her." Apostrophe and he also said, in reference to Nell Gwyn, "Do not let poor Nellie starve." Apostrophe, he died in the 55th year of his age, and the 25th of his reign. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.